Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the first lecture in the 2006 Election Law Lecture Series. Today, we're going to start with a topic that is quite timely, I think, and quite interesting, felon disenfranchisement, felon voting. The way this series is going to work is generally we will have a paper on the main topic presented by one or more persons, giving you some background, setting forth their position on that topic. And then we will follow that up by a comment period by someone who may have some different viewpoints. Hopefully we'll have at least some differing viewpoints to keep it interesting. Today we have presenting the main paper on felon disenfranchisement, Roger Clegg and George Conway. Roger is the President and General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity, which is a conservative research and educational organization that deals with a variety of issues, including civil rights, immigration, and bilingual issues. They're generally focused, to my experience at least, on equal opportunity, as the name suggests, on affirmative action, on discrimination issues, and always interesting, always provocative, and always rigorous. Roger, prior to joining the Center for Equal Opportunity, Roger worked in the federal government from 1982 to 1993 in the Department of Justice, holding a variety of positions, including assistant to the Solicitor General and a number two official in both the Civil Rights Division and the Environmental Division. So certainly from his DOJ experience, he has plenty of background with equal rights and civil rights issues, and I think that background is well reflected in the paper. Also, he's a graduate of Rice University in Yale, the latter of which I'm sorry to say we usually hold against people, but we'll make an exception for Roger. I think Roger has gotten where he's gotten despite Yale. George Conway comes from a different, somewhat different background. George is a litigation partner at the top flight law school of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz in New York City. Many of you obviously have heard of that firm, and it's one of the finest firms in the country. George generally specializes in sort of takeover and securities litigation, but has branched out into the civil rights field, at least in the current instance, as he explains, because of his involvement in a couple of New York cases dealing precisely with this issue, felon voting. And he and Roger, in fact, authored amicus brief in support of the state of New York, I guess it was, Governor Pataki, in those cases. And Elliot Spitzer. Would never want to leave out any mention of Mr. Spitzer as a defendant in any case whatsoever. Never. Anyway, so Roger, of course, has prior to joining Wachtell, he has backgrounds in government as well, at least to the limited degree of having been a law clerk to the Honorable Ralph K. Winter on the Second Circuit. Judge Winter, as you all know, is one of the finest judges from that court. And he was law clerk there, pushing a decade, almost two decades ago now, I guess it was. Sorry about that, George. It's okay. I'm that old as well. George also went to Yale. I won't repeat my insults about Yale, but take them as incorporated herein. Responding to the paper will be Mark Maurer. Mark is the executive director of the Sentencing Project and has been involved in criminal justice reform for over 30 years. As many of you, if you're involved in the criminal area, may know, the Sentencing Project has dealt with numerous issues, particularly issues involving race discrimination in sentencing and incarceration and related matters. Prior to joining the Sentencing Project, he was with the American Friends Service Committee. That was from 75 to 86, and again, addressing similar issues, obviously. And then from 87 to 2005, he was the assistant director of the Sentencing Project, becoming its executive director in 2005. Mark received his BA from Stony Brook University and a Master of Social Work from the University of Michigan, and I think will bring a unique perspective to us, usually sort of blinded lawyers, as to the social consequences of a lot of the sort of fine legal issues that we often find ourselves dealing with. Anyway, without further ado, I will leave the remainder of this to the participants. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll start with some of the background of these cases that we're going to be talking about and the background behind felon disenfranchisement, as well as some of the background behind the statutory, the history of the Voting Rights Act of of 1965 in Section 2, which is the basis of the claims against the felon disenfranchisement laws. Today, 48 states and the District of Columbia have laws disenfranchising felons to various extents. In each of those states, people convicted of felonies are not permitted to vote, at the very least, while they are serving their sentences. Today, only two states, Maine and Vermont, have no disenfranchisement laws whatsoever. In those states, people can vote even while they're in jail. The opponents of felon disenfranchisement laws have engaged in recent years in a campaign to try to repeal or at least curtail some of the statutes that the states have, and they've had some success, as I'll describe later. But they haven't had success in repealing the statutes, and if anything, they've lost a little ground. And partly, perhaps as a result of that, they put a lot of effort into legal challenges against felon disenfranchisement laws. In particular, of late, the challenges have relied upon the Voting Rights Act. The claims under the Voting Rights Act go like this. Blacks and Latinos are incarcerated for felonies at higher rates than the population as a whole, and therefore they are disenfranchised at higher rates. And that violates, the claim goes, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, because Section 2 says flatly that states can impose no voting qualification or prerequisite to voting that results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color. Regardless of what the state's intent is in disenfranchising felons, the argument goes, disenfranchising felons has the effect, as shown by the statistical evidence, of discriminating against blacks and Hispanics. Now, they've had some success in making that argument. They actually won a case in the Ninth Circuit, a case called Farrakhan against Washington, where the district court had thrown out one of these claims on summary judgment and held that the statistical evidence really shouldn't be considered under the totality of the circumstances test under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The Ninth Circuit reversed and said that this sort of evidence should be considered under the totality of circumstances test under Section 2 and sent the case back for further proceedings. There was a dissent from a denial of rehearing on bank with Judge Kaczynski writing a powerful dissent joined by several other judges. The case then went to the Supreme Court, which denied cert, and then now is back in the district court where there are now cross motions for summary judgment. No one has quite won that case, but the plaintiffs did win a big victory in getting the Ninth Circuit to articulate a relatively lenient standard by which they could prove their claims. There was also a case from Florida that was defended successfully by Chuck Cooper, whom many of you here know. It's called Johnson against Bush. The state of Florida there won in the district court and then lost before a three-judge panel, and then it was a divided panel, and then the case was heard en banc. And last year, about a year ago, by a 10-2 vote, the 11th Circuit rejected the claims, and the Supreme Court denied cert there, too. Finally, there was a case challenging the voting, the felon disenfranchisement laws in New York, and that's the case that Roger and I was involved in. And that was decided just last Thursday by the Second Circuit sitting in bank. There are actually two cases. The first case was called Muntankim, and Mr. Muntankim had lost in the district court, and he appealed, and he had lost before a panel of the Second Circuit. And then the Supreme Court denied his cert petition, and after the Supreme Court denied his cert petition, the Second Circuit said, hey, let's take the case in bank. And at the same time they took the case in bank, they took another case called Hayden, which hadn't yet been decided by a panel, but it had also been dismissed by a district court. In fact, it had been dismissed because of the Muntankim ruling. And last week, the Second Circuit threw out Mr. Hayden's claim on the merits by an 8-5 vote, and then dismissed Mr. Muntankim's claim because it turned out he was actually a resident of California, didn't have standing. So he's got to go to the Ninth Circuit, which is better for him. He's got to apply for an absentee ballot because he lives in New York, actually, in a federal penitentiary. Now, the cases that got me interested were the Second Circuit cases. I'm a lawyer in New York, as you know, I'm a securities lawyer, as Eric mentioned. And I know nothing about this area of the law. Roger knows everything. I knew nothing. And the way I found out about the case was I got an email. I get these emails, you know, people looking for pro bono help, and they were looking for pro bono help in favor of the plaintiffs. And I said, gee, this is an interesting case, and I started reading about it. And I said, gee, I was curious, what did the plaintiffs do that got them disenfranchised? And the briefs didn't really say. neither did the opinion. So I did a little Lexis and a little Google, and it turned out that Mr. Mutankum, the plaintiff in the first case, was actually a guy named Anthony Bottom, and he was actually quite famous. He was famous, or infamous, I should say, because in 1971, he and an accomplice snuck up behind two New York City police officers who were just walking back to their cars, and one of the police officers was black, one was white, and Mr. Bottom and his accomplice ambushed them, blew them away. The black cop, whose name was Waverly Jones, was kind of lucky. He died immediately. The other cop, Joseph Piagentini, they emptied their clips into him. They ran out of bullets. And then he was still alive. He begged them to stop shooting. They took his gun, and they fired all the bullets in the officer's service revolver at him until they ran out of bullets. Mr. Piagentini, Officer Piagentini, died on the way to the hospital. And he left behind a wife and an 18-month-old daughter and a 3-year-old daughter who joined our amicus brief in the Second Circuit. Mr. Mutankum got 25 years to life, and that's why he can't vote. Now, not all of the folks who lose the right to vote because they're incarcerated are as bad as Mr. Mutankum. Mr. Hayden, the guy in the other case, only committed manslaughter. He just stabbed somebody with a butcher knife and killed him. Other of the co-plaintiffs really didn't do violent crimes. Some of them were just, you know, nonviolent drug offenders. And there were some plaintiffs in the Hayden case who were law-abiding citizens who were alleging vote dilution claims. They were alleging that because other people were disenfranchised, they were denied or abridged their right to vote. But the reason why I mention what Mr. Mutankum and Mr. Hayden did is because it illustrates perfectly the purpose and the idea behind felon disenfranchisement. Judge Henry Friendly, in a case from the Second Circuit in the 1960s dealing with an equal protection claim, he put it best. He said, someone who breaks the laws may fairly have been thought to have abandoned the right to participate in making them. It can scarcely be deemed unreasonable, Judge Friendly said, for a state to decide that the perpetrators of serious crimes shall not take part in electing the legislators who make the laws, the executives who enforce these, the prosecutors who must try them for further violations, or the judges who are to consider their cases. And that's certainly been the view of the states throughout American history. Felon disenfranchisement, in fact, goes beyond American history. It probably is as old as voting itself. There apparently is evidence that there was felon disenfranchisement in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and it appeared in Europe in the last millennia. It occurred in England also, although it really wasn't a big deal in 18th century England because most felonies there were punishable by death, so that sort of solved the voting problem. In pre-Civil War America, the states overwhelmingly adopted felon disenfranchisement. And you will hear from time to time people say, aha, that's proof that it was racially motivated. And that's not true. In fact, it's logically doesn't make any sense because by the time the 14th Amendment was passed, 29 states had state constitutions that either prohibited or permitted the legislature to prohibit felons from voting. The fact that they did that doesn't show racial motivation because blacks couldn't vote anyway. In the South, they were outright barred from voting. Even in a state like New York, a northern state, New York had property and residence requirements that were specifically applied only to black people that kept them from voting. And in fact, the plaintiffs in the Hayden case, one of the cases that was the case that was decided last week, alleged that 99% of blacks in New York couldn't vote because of those property requirements. Well, the fact that the states could just simply say blacks couldn't vote meant that they didn't need to use felon disenfranchisement as a ruse to keep blacks from voting. So the people who were affected by felon disenfranchisement in America before the Civil War were white people. Now, another historical point that's relevant to the Voting Rights Act claims is that the framers of the Reconstruction Amendments, the radical Republicans who did so much to promote civil rights for the freed slaves, saw nothing problematic whatsoever with felon disenfranchisement. And that most explicitly is reflected in Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, which actually expressly recognizes the power of the states to disenfranchise felons. It provides that states will have their representation in Congress reduced to the extent that states deprive adult males of the right to vote, except to the extent that the states were disenfranchising them for participation in rebellion or other crime. The Supreme Court in the 1974 case of Richardson against Ramirez cited this provision, Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, in rejecting a 14th Amendment challenge to California's felon disenfranchisement law. The court held that Section 2 of the 14th Amendment is an affirmative sanction of the exclusion of the felons from the vote, including felons like the plaintiffs in the Richardson case who were disenfranchised for life. Now, there is also, I mean, Richardson dealt with the 14th Amendment claim, but it also is relevant to the 15th Amendment as well, the 15th Amendment providing for voting rights, that the states can't deny voting rights on the basis of race or color. The Richardson case described how throughout Reconstruction, as we all know, Congress is passing statutes readmitting states to the Union. And readmitting states to the reunion, to the Union, the Congress was approving the new state constitutions of these southern states that were getting back into the Union. These constitutions, many of them, had felon disenfranchisement laws. A number of state constitutions were actually approved by the very same Congress that proposed the 15th Amendment. And the 15th Amendment, as you know, is the principal constitutional authority for the Voting Rights Act, and the people who proposed the 15th Amendment thought felon disenfranchisement was okay. Since then, the Supreme Court has uttered words of approval for felon disenfranchisement laws, albeit not in the context of a Voting Rights Act claim. There was Richardson against Ramirez, the case I mentioned. There was an 1890 case where the Supreme Court said that a territorial legislature had the power to disenfranchise felons. A 1959 Warren Court case where the Supreme Court in dictum unanimously said that a criminal record was one of the factors that a state could consider in determining the qualification of voters. And even as recently as 1996 in Romer against Evans, the Supreme Court said in dicta that the holding that a convicted felon may be denied the right to vote remains unexceptionable. Now, in modern times on the legislative front, as I mentioned earlier, the states have somewhat liberalized the felon disenfranchisement laws. And the way they've done that typically is to get rid of lifetime disenfranchisement, or at least cut it back. They either cut it back to the way New York does it, to have disenfranchisement only during terms of incarceration and parole, or they only have lifetime disenfranchisement for second offenders. They've done this in a number of ways, and as a result, the trend in the states today is toward disenfranchising felons only for their sentences of parole or for incarceration, parole, or probation. In 2001, the National Commission on Federal Election Reform, which is a bipartisan blue ribbon panel that was chaired by Presidents Carter and Ford, looked at the issue and concluded that, you know, this is an issue that's just up to the states. Whether to disenfranchise felons, whether to do it at all, whether to do it in part, whether to do it for life, was a moral judgment, they said, a moral judgment for the states. The best judgment, they said, is to do pretty much what New York does, which is to disenfranchise felons only during their periods of incarceration and parole or probation. But they said that states were still even free to do it for life if they wanted to. And they said that Congress probably doesn't have the constitutional authority to do anything about that. Today, there remains a very strong political support for felon disenfranchisement. As I said, I mentioned earlier that the opponents of felon disenfranchisement have actually lost ground. 10 years ago, there were four states, not two, four states that allowed felons to vote even while they were serving their sentences. In addition to Maine and Vermont, the states I mentioned earlier, there was Massachusetts and Utah. In 1998, it was put to the people of Utah on a ballot referendum on a constitutional amendment to prevent felons who were incarcerated from voting. And the constitutional amendment passed 82% to 18%. Now, that was a red state. What about a blue state? Massachusetts, where I grew up, had a similar referendum in 2000. The people of that famously liberal state voted by a margin of 64% to 34% to pass a constitutional amendment barring incarcerated felons from voting. So from coast to coast, people still support disenfranchising felons, at least while they are in prison. Now, all of this is very interesting, or maybe not, but what of the Voting Rights Act? The plaintiffs and the judges who have ruled in their favor, particularly the dissenters last week in the Second Circuit, say that the statutory language of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is unambiguously in their favor. It says, no voting qualification or prerequisite or to voting or standard or practice or procedure shall be imposed or applied by any state or any political subdivision in a manner which results in the denial or abridgment of the rights of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color. The plaintiff's argument is no means no. It means that every voting qualification is covered, no exceptions, including no exception for felon disenfranchisement. The dissenters in the Second Circuit relied heavily on this argument, there was actually a fascinating role reversal where the liberals who were in dissent were chastising the conservative majority for ignoring the plain language of the statute and reading whatever they wanted out of the legislative history. But the fact is, the no part of the statute is only part of the statute. The statute is ambiguous in other portions of the language. A voting qualification or prerequisite is legal under Section 2 if it results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color. What does that mean? The Department of Justice chimed in the Muntakem and Hayden cases with an argument that focused on the words right to vote. And the Justice Department argued that felons don't have the right to vote under the Constitution because states don't have to give it to them. And so therefore, if the states don't give it to them, well, that's not a deprivation of the right to vote within the meaning of the Constitution or the Voting Rights Act. Not a bad argument. There's also the reference to denial of the right to vote on account of race. And the key words, on account of, which actually tracks the language of the 15th Amendment. As some of the judges on the 11th Circuit noted, and as a panel of the 6th Circuit noted about 20 years ago, people who are subject to felon disenfranchisement aren't disenfranchisement, denied the right to vote on account of race. They're denied on account of race, denied the right to vote because they've committed crimes. But in the end, the best that can be said for the plaintiffs' arguments is that the statutory language is ambiguous, which means under the canons of statutory interpretation, you have to look at the legislative history of the Voting Rights Act. And that's absolutely fatal to the plaintiff's claim, as the Second Circuit and the 11th Circuit have now made clear. In 1965, when Congress enacted the original version of the Voting Rights Act, there was a provision that they were concerned, that people were concerned might impact felon disenfranchisement laws. And that was Section 4 of the Act, which contained a list of devices and procedures that could not be used in the so-called covered jurisdictions, the jurisdictions that had histories of using literacy tests and other devices to keep blacks from voting. Section 4 said that covered jurisdictions could not impose any requirement of good moral character to keep people from voting. And there was a concern that, hey, well, maybe that implicates felon voting, felon disenfranchisement. And the Senate Judiciary Committee report went out of its way, a joint statement of Senator Kennedy and 9 other senators, where they made expressly clear that they didn't think that was a problem, that this provision, this very specific provision, which was the closest anyone could think of that came to talking about felon disenfranchisement, did not touch it. The statement they said that was that Section 4 would not result in the prescription of the frequent requirement of states and political subdivisions that an applicant for voting or registration for voting be free of conviction of felony. The House Judiciary Committee report had basically the same statement. And Senator Tidings, a major proponent of the act, actually mentioned felon disenfranchisement on the Senate floor. He said the statute didn't affect felon disenfranchisement laws because those laws, quote, are objective, easily applied, and do not lend themselves to fraudulent manipulation. Now, in response to this legislative history, the plaintiffs and the dissenting judges last week said, well, those statements are about Section 4. They're not about Section 2, so they're completely irrelevant. Well, the response to that is, it's hard to imagine that Congress, at the same time that it was going out of its way to say that it wasn't outlawing felon disenfranchisement in covered jurisdictions, the ones that they were most worried about, at the same time it was doing that, it was in Section 2 enacting another provision that cast doubt on felon disenfranchisement from coast to coast. It doesn't make any sense. The other argument that the plaintiffs and the dissenting judges make is that, hey, you shouldn't be looking at 1965 because the statute was amended in 1982, as everyone knows, to get rid of the intent requirement that the Supreme Court imposed in the Mobile, Alabama case. And in 1982, in the legislative history of 1982, Congress was completely silent on felon disenfranchisement. So the plaintiffs say you can't infer anything from silence. You just have to go back to the plain language of the statute. Well, the response to that is, first of all, as the panel decision in Muntakim said, it's just unfathomable, and that's the word the court used, to imagine that that Congress meant to overturn felon disenfranchisement laws from coast to coast without saying so. But it's even better. The argument's even better than that for the defendants. In 1982, all Congress said that it was doing when it was reenacting Section 2 and amending it was to restore what its original intent that the Supreme Court had messed up. Well, if that's what Congress was doing, restoring what it meant to enact in 1965, and in 1965 it was saying that felon disenfranchisement was okay, well, then obviously it didn't have a problem with felon disenfranchisement in 1982. Now, that's all there is about felon disenfranchisement in the history, the legislative history of the Voting Rights Act, but there's actually some more history of congressional action that actually confirms the point. In 1972 and 1973, Congress actually considered some proposals to amend the Voting Rights Act to prohibit states from disenfranchising felons who have served their sentences from participating in federal, not state, elections. And they actually held hearings on that and held hearings on whether they could even do that. They were concerned that they couldn't constitutionally do that. Well, they wouldn't have been holding those hearings and they wouldn't have been discussing those bills if they thought they'd already done something about felon disenfranchisement. They knew they hadn't. And in recent years, Congress has actually made it easier, has taken steps to make it easier to disenfranchise felons. In 1993, in the National Voter Registration Act, Congress actually required federal prosecutors to notify states of federal felony convictions so that the states could then strike the convicted persons off the voting rolls. And then in 2002, in the Help America Vote Act, Congress actually instructed state officials to purge disenfranchisement felons from voting lists on a regular basis. And then in 2002, 2003, 2004, and 2005, Congress actually again considered bills much like the bills that were before it in 1972 and 73. Again, very narrow bills. They would not abolish felon disenfranchisement for incarcerated prisons. They'd only abolish it for people who had served their sentences and then only in federal election. Very narrow provisions. None of these proposals ever made it out of committee. And at one point, when they were considering the Have America Vote Act of 2002, somebody introduced, I think Senator Reid introduced, a floor amendment that would add such a provision to the Have America Vote Act. And the amendment failed. Bipartisan vote, 31 to 63. Bottom line is that in 1965 and 1982, when Congress passed and amended the Voting Rights Act, Congress did not intend to outlaw felon disenfranchisement. And at no time since 1965 or 1982 did Congress even think it had done so. And at no time in the entire history of the United States has Congress ever wanted to do so. And that's all you need to know about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as far as it implicates felon voting. But there are other compelling and dispositive reasons why these disparate impact claims should fail. There is the clear statement rule of Gregory against Ashcroft, which is dealt with in our paper, which I won't discuss. And then there are constitutional issues that my friend and colleague Roger Clegg will now address along with the policy issues. Thanks.
It's nice to have a good lawyer. I want to thank, first of all, the Federalist Society for putting on this event, and I want to thank Mark Maurer for coming to this very hostile crowd that will probably throw rotten vegetables at you. But it's very nice of you to come. But most of all, I want to thank George and also Ken Lee, his associate at Wachtell Lipton, for the terrific job that they did writing the brief in the Muntakim case and also writing the paper with some poor suggestions from me. But, I mean, basically it was it was their work, and they did a terrific job on it. And it's been great working with George throughout this whole process. Well, as I think George has, and as the paper I think makes very clear, very hard to make the case that the Voting Rights Act is supposed to get at felon disenfranchisement. And as George also mentioned, it's very hard to argue that the Constitution makes it illegal to have these felon disenfranchisement statutes either. You know, for starters, the 14th Amendment, Section 2, explicitly contemplates that states are going to have felon disenfranchisement statutes. The Supreme Court has made clear that in order to have a violation of the 14th or the 15th Amendment, you have to be acting with racial intent. There has to be actual disparate treatment as opposed to just disparate impact. And the while there were, right after Reconstruction, from 1890 to 1910, five southern states that did use the felon disenfranchisement statutes there deliberately to disenfranchise blacks, those laws are no longer on the books. As George pointed out, the 48 states that have these now can trace their origins to ancient Greece and ancient Rome and colonial America, and there simply is no case to be made that these statutes are rooted in a desire to disenfranchise people on the basis of race or ethnicity. So what we're left with then is the policy question of whether states should have these laws or not. And I'm just going to say a little bit about why I think these laws make sense. It's not purely a policy argument because this also has some relevance to the Voting Rights Act claim, because even in the Ninth Circuit, if you buy the argument that, well, yeah, in theory you ought to be able to bring a Section 2 Voting Rights Act claim against a felon disenfranchisement statute and you show that it has a disparate impact and all that, I think the case law makes clear that the state gets a rebuttal opportunity, just as it does in any disparate impact case. It can show that it has a really good reason for whatever the practice is. And I'm going to talk about some of the really good reasons that we have for not letting criminals vote. The one way to look at it is the way that Judge Friendly looked at it and that George quoted. The basic idea is that